tell me about the field trips you were doing then. What were they like?
Oh, yes, they were very exciting to begin with. Well, one of the things was not having a professional mechanic with us. We weren't supposed to use the Muskeg tractors that lived on the Fossil Bluff base because they were, you know, fairly serious pieces of machinery, and you needed more than just, you know, I can get my car started in the morning knowledge in order to operate them properly. Fortunately, Andy Wager, having spent his first year at Halley Bay, and he was very friendly with the Black Gang there, had spent a lot of time with the mechanics and was interested in that and had watched them and knew quite a lot about the way they ran their Muskegs and other tractors at Halley Bay. I had, as Charles Swithinbank had found out, you know, reasonable competence with petrol engines and mechanical things in general, although I was a civil engineer rather than a mechanical one. And between the two of us, we reckoned that we would be able to cope all right with motor toboggans, you know, Fox tracks, which are like a sort of lawnmower engine on a... Well, they're forerunners of skidoos, but much more primitive. We thought we would manage with those okay. And so that was the idea. So the Glacio team had two Fox tracks, and the idea was we would take the geologists into their base area for the autumn to do their work, and then we would get on with glaciology. Well, of course, we only had one fox track because the other had to be left behind at Adelaide, so that was a bit difficult. Can one fox track take four people with sledges anywhere sensible? Well, we don't know. Let's try. And the answer was, in those conditions, no, it can't. And we had significant problems with the drive chain breaking and things, and so we had to come humiliatingly back to base, having jury-rigged a difficult repair. And we asked for permission to use the Muskegs because this clearly wasn't going to be a goer. And after some hesitation, this was given. And there were two field Muskegs on the base, which were sort of allowed to go off the base rather than just up to the airstrip to get loads from the aeroplane. One of which was having its tracks repaired, and that hadn't been finished by the time that the season ended. So we had one that we could use. And Mike Bell had, in his spare time, been working on finishing the repair to the track to the other one, and fortunately he just about got it finished by the time that we then started off again. So we took the Muskeg out, and we knew that it was going to be difficult to restart this beast in the morning. It's a petrol engine, goes down to minus 30 or below very easily out there, but we knew, and Andy Wager knew in particular, that what you can do is petrol dilution, you dilute the oil in the sump with petrol and then run the engine for a bit, not too long, just to get it mixed in. And then in the morning, the oil's nice and thin. It's not like jelly, which otherwise it is. And also, we knew that batteries are a bit dodgy when it's as cold as that. So we had carefully taken a backup generator with us, a thing we called a Briggs & Stratton, from the engine that ran it. So we set off with the Muskeg and with a man hauling sledge as a kind of lifeboat in case the worst really came to the worst, and with some spare batteries, but they had to be kept warm, so they'd got to be in the cab of the Muskeg or in a tent. And it was a real nuisance, you know, dealing with the batteries, because you park up for the night and you've got to take the batteries out and into the tent to keep them warm. And then in the morning when you want to restart again, you've got to get the batteries out and hooked up and everything and get the engine whirring before anything else can happen. So we did that. We did a reasonable mileage the first day in the end, the four of us, and the Muskeg wouldn't start. The batteries were knackered. So, well, we had feared that this might be the case, so let's charge them up. And the Briggs & Stratton wouldn't work. We could start it, but it wouldn't charge, and we couldn't find out why. What the heck was the matter with it? And we took the thing to bits, and we took the... Absolutely no idea. We couldn't... So what are we going to do? The only thing we can do is walk back to the base, pulling this little sledge behind us. And it's 25 miles. It's going to take us at least 2 days because we're not very good at manhauling, and it's not like Captain Scott and his fit men. So that's what we did. And it took us 3 days, and we arrived at the base pretty well exhausted. And we then had to think, well, what are we going to do? Well, what we could do, fortunately, was take the other Muskeg out to rescue the first one. But before we could do that, what was the matter with the Briggs & Stratton? We couldn't find it. We had another Briggs & Stratton. We tried that. It wouldn't work either. This is ridiculous. What are these gremlins up to? And, oh dear, I mean, reading my diaries back again since then, and the Foxtrot was having weird problems as well, apart from the chain case that... The chain drive that was having problems. But basically, in the end, just when it was getting really quite dark and the winter was setting in, two of them, Andy and Mike Elliott, did go out with the other muskeg, and they managed to start the other one because we had another device called a Herman Nelson heater, which had been used for the petrol-engined aircraft in the old days. There was one of these kept at the bluff in case a single-engine otter turned up and had to stay some time and needed to start its engine again. So we could take that with us on the sledge. And it was the one thing that never, ever failed us was the Herman Nelson. It had some special methylated spirit device that you could actually preheat it as a petrol engine to get the petrol to evaporate so that the engine would start, and it never failed. That was great. So we took that with us both times, actually, but it didn't start the muskeg the first time. But it did the second time, and so they brought it back again, and that was us for the winter. And meanwhile, you know, we were trying to do what we could with the Foxtrot and to get that jury rigged so it could work. And we eventually did manage to do that and try and find what was wrong with the Briggs and Strattons. We never did find out. Having stripped and reassembled them several times, all of a sudden it went. And then the other one did too. What did we do? We will never, ever know. Just one of the Antarctic's mysteries.
And you had a famous adventure with the generator at the base as well.
Yeah, that was another of the gremlins that we had. There was a nice little Petter diesel generator there which provided 250 volts for base power. Not very many, I forget, it was not very powerful, but it was enough to run the base very nicely and charge the batteries for the muskegs and everything. This had also been giving trouble and had needed repair and everything, and the diesel mechanics from Adelaide hadn't been able to get to it, and the air mechanic, John Walsh, who had been on the base over the previous winter from the Pilatus Porter incident, he had managed to keep the diesel going. But according to the diesel mechs, John Walsh's approach was not right. You know, he was trying to tune the thing like you can with a carburetor when it's running, and you just can't, they said. But anyway, as part of the sort of servicing of this thing and trying to keep it going, I had been doing some work on it, and we had one of these long-handled spanners that I foolishly left on the casing of the... It was an air-cooled diesel on the casing of the air duct. Started the engine up, and that was fine, it worked. And rattle, 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 to my horror, I see this spanner just disappearing into the air intake for the cooling air, and of course it whacked into the air vanes on the flywheel and grunched them to a halt in a cloud of noise and sparks. And I thought, oh my God, now what? And of course the casing was all riven as well, with sort of objects sticking into it from the inside. And having taken the casing off, it was actually quite encouraging that there was surprisingly little damage to the engine itself, but two of the vanes had been broken off the flywheel. So by sort of bashing the casing back into shape and repositioning it and everything and starting up the engine again, the engine ran all right. Well, of course it would, because this was just a cooling air problem, but it was hunting from side to side like this because it was unbalanced now, and I wasn't happy about it running like that for a long time. I thought, you know, other damage is likely to ensue, and got on the radio to various people in the area who might know better than that, and they all said, well, we don't know either until we can actually come and have a look at it. So we decided on the base that we wouldn't use that apart from just a very brief spell at midwinter, which we did. So again, privations and cosiness. We didn't have mains power. We did have 12 volt supply wired into the base, so there were 12 volt lamps here and there that you could switch on and off. We did have the Briggs and Strattons working by now, so we could recharge the 12-volt batteries, and we used tilly lamps. And so, again, it was actually cosy, although, going back to what you said, privations too. Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it, that one tiny moment can change the whole
absolutely
scenario for
yeah
a year.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and you think, gosh, you know, such a stupid thing to do, and yet so easily done. Mm. And the consequence is throw a huge long shadow, you know, stretching for months.
Because of the isolation?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
So winter was upon you?
Yes.
And was midwinter your first midwinter? Was that
memorable? Oh, that was great. Oh, it was, yes, that was great, because we did drink all the beer, for instance, and we had a menu and we invented things to eat and made a cake. And there was a model of Fossil Bluff that somebody had made in previous visits, made out of old tins and things, nicely painted. So we stuck that on our midwinter's cake and took photographs of it, and it was all it was very memorable.
How did you pass the time?
Well, that didn't seem to be a problem, and I reckoned, actually, towards the end of the winter, we were quite capable of sleeping 14 hours out of the 24 without thinking anything about it. Your sort of processes do slow down, there's no doubt. And during the rest of the time, we read things, we wrote things, we sort of tinkered around with geology or glaciology and the kit needed for doing that. There's always maintenance work and things or that you need to do, or you're preparing how are you going to record this stuff and writing up notebooks and that sort of thing. We didn't listen to the radio very much. We didn't have a portable radio at Fossil Bluff my first year. The radio schedules were very interesting, and we used to try to actually talk to Halley Bay and to a South African station right over the other side of Antarctica. And with the ionosphere moving about during the winter time, sometimes we found that on the frequencies which our radios could use, we could actually get our signals bouncing across and talk to these people, and that was very interesting. And so that we had a sort of weekly schedule with the South African guys at Borga Base. And for several weeks on the trot, we were able to meet it. And so that is always a sort of... It's just one thing in a week, but it's something that you think about during the rest of the week and talk about. So,
were you hearing anything of the rest of the planet?
Precious little. No. Our news was local news. It was, you know, what are the other sledge parties planning to do? And even during the winter, the Stonington sledges were out most of the time. And Adelaide sent sledge parties into the field as well. So that was always interesting. There was discussion about what the field programmes of next summer were going to involve, who was going to go where, and how that would all interlock. Some of that involved us laying depots for them in the spring. So that was important, and we had to think how we were going to do that sort of thing. And, you know, time went by congenially enough. We had decided that we would do synoptic weather observations between 9 a.m. and midnight just to give a sort of 24-hour structure to the day. And I personally think that was quite valuable, although not everybody in subsequent years went on doing that, I don't think. Certainly we did that both the years that I was there, partly for that reason.
Did it matter that you didn't know what was happening elsewhere in the world?
No, it didn't, actually. I don't think we worried about that at all. One thing that we used to quite gloatingly calculate from time to time is, supposing there's a nuclear Armageddon in the Northern Hemisphere, we think we could survive longer than anybody else whatsoever. And we figured out that we could actually last for 10 years down there without really seriously starving to death. Because there was an enormous dump of dog food there, which is actually eatable by humans, and that had been depoted in the past for dog sledging parties, and a lot of it did get used during the next two summers, but certainly that first winter, there was tons of the stuff there. And we had a lot of basic food on the base, although the luxuries hadn't come in on the resupply. There was boxes and boxes of food there, and that was the sort of thing that we did talk a little bit about. And then, well, what would we do? You know, well, sea level might rise. We'd have to build a boat out of something. What could we use to? Where would we go anyway? Oh, shut up! You know, that doesn't matter. Things like that. But the rest, we were aware of the Americans landing on the moon, but only just. And yes, okay, that's interesting. But meanwhile, we got some things to do, don't we?
Did your discussions about that kind of thing stretch as far as whether you want to carry on living for 10 years?
Only to the extent of saying, well, at the end of that time, what would we want to do? And so would we therefore have wanted to get to that stage? Yeah, so, but you know, it was all pretty light-hearted. I don't think anybody took it seriously. Yeah.
When the weather improved again, you know, you were back in the field, you were actually treading virgin territory, weren't you?
Some of the time, yes, and that was tremendously stimulating. I mean, the first bit of that I did was Andy Wager and I went down to the bottom end of George's Sixth Sound, which is where the elbow in the L shape I was talking about before is. And there are three very conspicuous nunataks down there, bits of rock showing out, surrounded by snowfields all around them. You can see them for a long, long, long way away, and they had only, as far as I know, once been visited before. So we went in there, and that was the sort of base point for one of our strings of markers across Georgia Sixth Sound. That was the southernmost one that we did. And, yeah, tremendously exciting to drive in there with your fox track. And can we go all the way? Are we going to have to walk? And actually to get up to the rock on all of these and look and see, because we knew that there was a sort of depot there of some kind with a message from the previous party who'd been there, but we didn't actually find that. But to know that probably only a couple of people have ever been here before, great. And then later on, sledging in the interior of Alexander Island, that was my second year, we certainly went to places that hadn't been trodden by human foot ever before. And we knew a bit what to expect from aerial photographs, and there had been expeditions before. The Ronnie expedition to Stoniton Island had been down there, and also Fuchs and Eady had made a great long trip that went a long way south. But you know, actually in the interior of Alexander Island, to sort of come round a corner, as it were, round one of these nunataks, and see a complete new vista, as if somebody had just got a black paintbrush and gone splat, 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 you know, and dotted lumps of black all over the white. And those were other nunataks that you could visit or not, depending on what it was you were trying to do. Yes, it was a wonderful feeling, that, definitely.
Can you elaborate slightly? You said, great, you're treading on land that nobody else has been to. Can you elaborate on the word great? Did your heart race? Did you feel like an explorer? Did you feel like a man on the moon?
I suppose, given those three options, I felt most like an explorer, but I knew that I wasn't really, because it was...
Why did you choose a fourth option?
Well, I think I felt like an amateur in the presence of something immense. I think right. That's how I would describe it, yes. Yeah.
Would that elaborate on the word immense? Were you aware of anything... Were you impressed by, in a spiritual way, by the Antarctic landscape?
I suppose so. Not being, a particularly spiritual person, that wouldn't have been the word that I thought of at the time. It would be some sort of word that means inducing contemplation, something like that. I certainly was moved to contemplate the vast scale of the scenery and my tiny, minuscule part in it, and even how small the whole party, you know, the whole of Bass and Fids and everything was in the scale of things down there. And that makes you feel humble in a way which I... Now, from my sort of venerable age, I can assert it's definitely a good thing for young men to be made to feel humble.
Yeah. Someone said to me on one of these interviews that if God exists, he would almost certainly choose to be in the Antarctic.
Yes. Well, yeah, I can sympathise with that. I think you certainly felt in the presence of something which you rarely get the chance to experience so clearly in what we call a civilised environment, yes.
Mm. Your predecessor, Cliff Pierce, describes fossil life as the silent sound. How did you cope with the silence?
Oh, I loved it, yeah. So, and it's not actually as silent as all that, mm-hmm. But it was very nice to go out of the base in the wintertime, in the dark, yeah, okay, yes, and not go too far away. And you could see the lighted windows there, and there's all this silence around you, there's no wind. But actually, it's not quite silent. And that, to me, is the thing about silence, is that it's almost never complete. And it's the little bits of incompleteness that make the experience. You can hear something, and you know it's a long way away, and it's not loud, but you can hear it. That's the experience. And suddenly, kaboomf, you know, a great big ice crack has appeared somewhere 20 miles away, but you've heard it. And that happens quite often with a floating ice shelf in Georgia Sixth Sound. So you do hear crunches and bangs. And, of course, there was a glacier flowing straight past the base at Fossil Bluff. You could step out and down 20 paces you were on it. And that moves and crunches and groans from time to time. So even when there's no wind, it's seldom absolutely quiet. And, of course, if you've got a generator running or anything, you can hear that from a long way away. Yeah.
Much wildlife in the winter?
Oh, no. Pretty well none, I would say. I can't... Wildlife at all. When you do find it, it's really very dramatic down there. You're 250 miles from the sea, 200 anyway, and less than that now, but in those days it was. So there's not much reason for anything to go down there. Some snowy petrels used to go down there. I think they nest on cliffs, and sometimes they're seen nesting down on, even further south on Alexander Island, but you don't see them much. And the experience I always remember is that they're white birds with black beak, black eyes, black claws. Everything else is snowy white. And we were travelling in what's a real whiteout, not the sort of whiteout that people talk about in the Highlands, which means sort of fog and clag and everything, but a real whiteout where there's a low sun, overcast sky, and no contrast, and you get no sense of scale, but you can see for miles. So you can see objects, if you've no idea how near or far away they are or how big. And suddenly, in these conditions, you know, these black things were moving in the air around us, in what is an absolutely static landscape. And you can't focus your eyes on them because you don't know how far away they are or anything, and they're not moving predictably. And in the end, your eyes lock on, and you realise that what you're seeing is the eyes and beak and claws of four of these snowy petrels that were flying around. That was a most weird experience, what they thought they were doing and why they were there. Who knows, but... That was one bit of wildlife, and almost the only other one that I can remember was meeting a penguin, and a daily penguin one day, plodging south down the Sound, 150 miles from the sea, heading south, all on his own. Where was he going? And again, it's startling. You think, is this a person? You see him in the distance, something walking along, and then you realise it's a penguin, and you think, oh great, fresh meat. And then you think, ah... Well, poor thing, you know, he's obviously being called by something, you know, let him get on with it. So we did. Yeah.
Did you miss company in that respect, if it was just the three of you, for weeks and weeks and months on end, four of you?
I suppose we did, but it's the sort of thing that you're mentally prepared for. You know that you're going to be just a foursome. Your mind is set with that expectation. And so, certainly in my case, it didn't rankle too much. You can talk to people on the radio, people you know at Adelaide, Stonington and so on. And so there is the sort of village effect that there are people down the street that you can talk to, even though they're actually 200 miles away. So, yeah, there was a feeling of community greater than just the four of us there in the block.
Well, what was the effect of the village effect as such? Because here we are... 40-odd years later,
yeah.
At a hotel in Bowness in Windermere, and all the people who've been down there are gathering together again for a reunion.
So, yeah.
You said in the papers that you felt that there was a sense of a village atmosphere about the Marguerite Bay.
Yeah.
And Fossil Bluff technically is in Marguerite Bay.
Yeah.
But it was on the Marguerite Bay.
Yes, it counts,
network,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
So what was special about that, and why is it still important 40 years later?
Well, why it's still important, goodness knows, but I think it was a virtual village. To me, that's the term I would use for it, that people do know what each other are doing and expect to help each other and be helped by them. And that's the FIDS experience anyway, on a base, exactly the same thing. People expect to have to help other people doing something completely alien to themselves, but never mind, you're going to help them. And if necessary, you would expect them to help you with no questions asked. And that expands out over the virtual village, is my explanation. And you know that you can rely on these other people. And people that you've got that sort of relationship with, you value, you tend to want to just keep in touch with them. It's not that you think you'll ever have to help them again or ever need them to help you, but just the bond has been forged and it's there. And yes, obviously, in some cases it weakens faster than others, and some it maybe even strengthens over time, but that's what forms it. And why it's valuable, that's just basic human nature, I would say. Yeah.
You picked up a Fuchs Medal in the year 2000.
yes.
I won't trust the citation, now you've proven it's quite accurate.
Yeah.
I think the thing we can rely upon is the fact that you did get this Fuchs Medal 30 years after
yes.
your time in the Antarctic, and you're the only person to get it who wasn't actually serving FID at the time, or serving...
Yeah, I believe that's true, yes, or a recently ceased serving FID, yes. Yes, I that hadn't occurred to me at the time until Pete Clarkson said that.
What was the first inkling you got that you might be up for this?
I think I got a phone call from... who did I get it from? I honestly can't remember who the phone call was from. It was either from Pete Clarkson himself, or it might have been from my friend Malky McRae, who had... I think he was one of the people who nominated me for it, and I think he might have warned me that it looked as if it was going to go through. I can't remember that, unfortunately, how I first knew about it.
Can you remember how you felt about it when you heard the rumour?
I was absolutely astonished. I thought, good heavens, that is incredible. And part of the incredulity, I suppose, is because of the fact that I didn't work for Bass and hadn't for a long time, so why would I be awarded this? But it wasn't just that. It was much more that I really didn't and don't think that I stack up against many of the other people who've been awarded Fuchs Medal in the past. Some of the things that they have done and their experience has been far more contributory to Bass and its aims than what I did, I think. You know, because...
It's largely for the reunion work you're doing, isn't it?
Yes.
You must think the reunions are important.
I do think the reunions are important, to me, certainly.
And 40, 50
and it seems that they're important to other people as well, and so therefore I was prepared to organise them. And when the previous pair of organisers of these reunions decided they'd had enough of it and were proposing just to stop doing it, I didn't think that was a good idea, so stepped in, along with Adrian Apps, to make sure they kept going. So he and I ran it for another 10 years, ending up with the cruise to Marguerite Bay in 2000, and at which time I thought, you know, I think I've done enough of this, really. If somebody else likes to take it over, so much the better. But that seemed to be enough, and so the Fuchs Medal turned up as a result. Yes, it seems to be mostly as a result of those two things, yes. Is services to FIDS after they've finished serving on bases most of the time.
So tell me about going south again 30 years later. How did you feel?
It was just a continuous 3-week party. It was just wonderful. I mean, the conviviality of the group of passengers that came together for that, and the fact that we were able to get down into Marguerite Bay again and enjoy that part of the experience and see Deception Island and many other places was, again, to me, and I think to everybody who went, was tremendously valuable. Big disappointment that we couldn't get into Stonington Island. Personally, I had a big disappointment that I didn't think that I actually handled that situation very well with the expedition leader at the time, or with the captain of the ship. So that, to me, is actually far more of a disappointment than the fact that we didn't actually get to Stonington. But I hope that nobody else was particularly aware of that at the time or later. But I still do feel could do better, George.
But, do you want to elaborate on that one?
Well, yes. Okay, I mean, I don't want to sort of throw historical sort of hand grenades at people, but I was particularly incensed that when we had been invited to moor up at Adelaide, which was a rare privilege, rare privilege that most cruise ships weren't asked to do that. We were, and we would have loved it. And the base was ready for us and had prepared. That the captain of the ship declined to do that on the grounds that his chart didn't show enough holdfast points, only 2. Well, we knew that there were not just 4, but 5, actually, and we had with us on board at the time a hydrographer who had with him the latest Admiralty charts showing quite clearly these holdfast points. Rothera is only a radio call away. Ask them. If you're not prepared to take their word for it, send your first officer ashore in a Zodiac and do an inspection. Don't just say no. And he said, no, I'm not going to do that. And consequently, it was very inconvenient for us as passengers, and I was quite indignant about that, and said so at the time in a way which really upset the expedition leader.
The
Canadian Shane. He was really upset about that. And he wanted to summon me in front of the captain. Well, I wanted to go and see the captain anyway. And that actually, once... you know, I'd sort of explain things to him a bit. He wouldn't budge on mooring at Adelaide, but he did explain some of his problems, which were that he didn't have a bow thruster. His minimum steerage way was 4 knots. If he hits some of these bits of ice that we'd been complaining he wouldn't go into at that speed, he's going to do serious damage. And his sister ship, which does have a bow thruster and did have reversible pitch propellers, had got him stuck in ice up at the north end of Adelaide Island 6 weeks previously and had to be very expensively rescued by an Argentine icebreaker, costing his Russian company lots and lots of valuable foreign currency, so he wasn't prepared to do that. Well, I could understand that, but what's that got to do with not mooring up at Adelaide? I could understand his reluctance to go into the ice, which a lot of the FIDs hadn't understood well, and yeah. I could pass that on. But Shane was thereafter treated me almost as a mutineer, and I thought that was a pity.
Do you think that disagreement then had an impact on the decision not to go into Sunnington later? Was trust gone?
No, I don't think so. Yeah. No, in fact, I think this was after that anyway.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't. I'd have to check, but I think that was after it. Yeah.
It was a huge success, that trip, George, wasn't it?
Well, for me it was, and I think everybody who went on it thought so too.
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
I don't know why I did. I was a mere non-fit passenger.
Yeah. Well,
so
no.
I hope that the episode outside Rotherhead didn't. Bitter the pill completely.
No, not at all. No, I have very happy memories. Indeed, it was just a fantastic party that went on afterwards. You know, when we got together 6 weeks later at a hotel to show all our slides, it was as if we'd seen each other yesterday. Everybody's yakking away and chat.
We have 1 minute left.
Oh,
how did you react to the state of the Antarctic?
Well, during that trip, I think the thing that astonished me most was actually to see aerial photographs of Fossil Bluff and how much the ice and the glacier had melted away. That was just absolutely extraordinary. You know, I'd heard of things like the Weardy ice shelf melting. Yeah, well, you know, never thought much of that anyway. Georgia 6 Sound, it's melting back. Well, that's not surprising. It does that from time to time. But Fossil Bluff, that's my home. Where do you get water from now when it's all dust and rock and everything? Yeah, so that was really a blow to the heart, I thought. Yeah, and the fact that people don't live there anymore is very sad as well. It was such a comfy home. Yeah.
George, thank you very much.
Most welcome.